What would you do if schools closed because of coronavirus? We asked, you answered.
My plan is to take my grandchildren and take care of them so that their parents can continue working.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and today on The Takeaway for March 5th, we talk about the ongoing threat of coronavirus. Also, come October 1st, Americans will need to get what's called the Real ID. But if you don't have the proper paperwork, you're gonna have issues.
You're not going to be able to get one of these real IDs, and it is going to make it more difficult for you. Say if you worked at a federal facility, maybe you were a janitor or someone else working in there, and now you don't have the real ID needed to get into the building.
Plus, space programs are popping up all around the world.
Kenya, Egypt, Nigeria, South Africa, Morocco, they've all launched their own programs to expand their space policy.
Let's get to it.
Hi, my name is Imran calling from Irving, Texas. I have actually not been sending my son to school for last Thursday or Wednesday because I knew I was following the news and I knew that this thing is going to go wild.
This is Katrina from Maplewood, New Jersey. If my son's schools are closed, it is likely that my university will be closed as well and I can be home. Really, really lucky and blessed that I don't have to worry about if schools are closed.
My name is Virginia and we live in Lexington, Virginia. We go to a alternative Montessori school and we've actually already self-declared as homeschoolers with our county so that in the event that we need to quarantine ourselves, we are already ready to do that.
You've probably been talking with your friends and family about what you would do if the coronavirus touches your life. It's the same conversation people are having all over the U.S. right now.
This is Catherine from Ridgewood, New Jersey. I am the grandmother of school-aged children, and those school-aged children live in Kirkland, Washington, the epicenter of the coronavirus in the country right now. I've already reached out to my son and daughter-in-law to say, look, if you need us to come there, we can come there. If you want to come here, you can come here. So that's the plans that we're making in order to deal with school closures.
My name's Jennifer from Summit, New Jersey. I'm actually a teacher, so planning on making some video lessons and trying to keep up with things. Again, managing expectations means some families might not have access to the internet, or some families may have parents who have to triage their own work at home.
Schools are becoming a bigger part of this conversation, and many districts are preparing for the possibility that the virus could force them to close for extended periods. This affects you even if you don't have children. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is now telling schools to prepare for remote learning. And in New York City, students are worried. Hundreds of teens have already signed petitions asking for their schools to suspend classes. Some countries have already shut school doors and sent all students home to wait out the virus. In Japan and in Italy, all schools are closed. And in China, tens of thousands of courses have moved online. The big question right now, can closing schools, disrupting the education of tens of millions of students, help contain the outbreak? Let's talk about it. Kaylin Belsha is with us. She's a national education reporter for Chalkbeat. Kaylin, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Rano Dillon. He's a physician and faculty member in global health equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Rano, glad you could join us.
Great to be with you.
Rano, how common is it for schools to close in reaction to public health situations like this?
So there's a long history of using school closures at times for when we've had epidemics in the past. Even as recently as the 2009 flu season, there were some school closures done then. The data on how well school closures work is mixed, and some of that is the fact that it really depends on how it's executed and when it's executed. So there are situations where it can make sense to do that, and a lot of that hinges on what the picture of the epidemic in a local community is at any moment to determine whether it makes sense or not to go that route.
So what's the thinking here? Is it that we want to protect the children, or are we trying to stop them from spreading the virus? How do we think about school closings?
In an epidemic, when we think about school closings, we think about both of those factors, and oftentimes protecting children first and foremost. In fact, Japan has closed all its schools, primarily because there was an interest in trying to protect kids from getting sick. One thing we've learned, or at least seen so far with this coronavirus epidemic, is that children seem to be the ones that are either getting infected the least or more likely having only milder symptoms when infected and not getting as serious illness as older adults especially are getting. And so protecting children is still part of the factor, but really stamping out transmission is going to be a big reason to consider school closures as this epidemic seems to be ramping up in the U.S. And a lot of that is that kids, even when they may not be getting so ill themselves, are certainly going to be transmitting to one another, and then those kids are going to go to their homes and then be able to propagate the virus further.
So, Ranu, are U.S. standards similar to those in Italy and in Japan?
Well, across the board, it seems that countries will issue some kind of nationwide guidance, but then leave it to the discretion of the local schools or local school districts. For example, in the UK, their national guidance is to hold back on school closures, yet they're also letting their local school principals decide if the situation in their area merits it. But generally speaking, our recommendations are similar, which is to say that if you have pockets of transmission, especially transmission beyond known cases where you think that their virus might be spreading unseen in the community, then it makes sense to consider closing schools, at least until you get a grip on what that transmission is, and more importantly, till that peak of transmission has subsided. So what we do know from studying past epidemics when school closures have been done is that what school closures can do more clearly than anything else is reduce the peak rate of infection, meaning trying to limit the intensity of having hundreds and hundreds of cases at any one moment when especially the health system would get overwhelmed by trying to respond to that many cases.
You said a key word here, Ranu, closing schools at least until the peak has subsided. How long could at least be?
Well, when I'm talking about a peak, not so much the peak of an epidemic globally or even nationally, but really locally. So right now, from one of the challenges we're facing is we don't have a clear understanding of where transmission or how widely transmission is happening in the U.S. because of the lack of testing. So that's an issue that I know has been talked about a lot in the media and elsewhere. But once we actually have a sense of how much transmission is happening and where it's happening, we'd be able to understand better the way to use school closures. But right now, the best sense we have is that there are communities where you have localized transmission. So what you would want to do is, as you have cases moving to maybe new areas, you may close schools to prevent the epidemic from taking root in that community and from spreading widely, making sure that whatever cases may filter into that community, you've been able to contain. And then once you feel like you have a grip on that, on those cases, you can then potentially reopen schools. And that way have mitigated the chance for the virus to really spread widely in that community or in that school district.
Kaylin, what has the CDC told schools so far?
So far, most of what they've communicated has been around developing emergency plans. They want schools to look at their infectious disease plans, make sure that they have lines of communication open with their parents, make sure that they're instructing children to wash their hands, not to touch their face. A lot of schools are continuing what they would normally do to clean surfaces that are often touched. They're making sure that janitors are doing what they would normally do. And then there's also been some talk about trying to plan for a disruption in learning. So we've been seeing a lot of schools haven't made it as far on that. And so whether or not they decide to take up virtual learning or they try some other method is kind of something that remains to be seen and will certainly depend on how long the schools are closed for.
From a systemic view, Kaylin, what would extended school closures mean for students and for parents?
So there's a number of challenges that could pose. A lot of students rely on their breakfast and lunch to come from school. So the CDC has issued some guidance around maybe there could be places where students could come and still get food. There's a lot of concern around the continuity of learning. And so if you had schools closed for a few days, it probably wouldn't be that disruptive. But if we're talking about long-term closures where schools would have to be closed for weeks or months at a time, certainly they would have to come up with a plan to continue learning. A lot of schools are not set up right now for remote learning, and so we're starting to see confusion about whether or not schools would be able to do that. A lot of students don't have internet at home or may not have devices at home to be able to do that. So we do see some teachers are starting to prepare for that, but whether or not that could be implemented on a wide scale, it really remains to be seen.
So we're really seeing the inequality being exposed by the coronavirus, because some students are going to have to stay home. Others will have resources, but some will not. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that we've seen in other countries where there's been widespread closures is that parents who've been able to work from home are an advantage. They're able to supervise their children, although even that is very difficult if you're working from home to be able to watch your child while they're taking lessons, versus other parents who may not be able to stay home with their children around the clock and monitor them while they're doing their schoolwork. That's certainly an equity issue. The equity issue has also to do with whether or not they have the devices and internet at home. We have seen during other natural disasters like the wildfires in California, some districts have invested in buying devices and in buying Wi-Fi routers for children and then distributing them so they can take those lessons. But those are a lot harder to do, you know, when you're doing it on a wider scale. And if you don't have a lot of time to prepare, most experts say it's really hard to implement an online learning plan if you haven't already been laying the groundwork to do so.
Ranu, earlier you mentioned that kids seem less susceptible to the coronavirus, although I understand a lot of that is still, we're still trying to understand it. But does that mean that if you are younger than 18, you're less susceptible, or is there a particular age range? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, so far from the data that's available from the case reports that we've gotten from different countries, it really looks like the brunt of infection is happening among adults older than 18, and the patients who are developing the more serious versions of the illness and the deaths have been clustered among people who are even in an older age bracket and also have other pre-existing health conditions. Among kids school-going age, you know, in one report, it was less than 3% of the cases were detected among them, and the number that developed severe illness was as low as 2%, and the number that required ICU-level care, like what's happening for a lot of adults, was even less than that. So definitely from those case reports, it seems that children are less susceptible to serious illness from infection so far. Now the question is, and that we don't have the information on, is how much are kids actually having milder symptoms, maybe something that looks more like a common cold that goes away in a couple of days. Even though that's milder in the illness they're experiencing, they still could be propagating a lot of infection to their family members and other people in their community. And that's the central concern right now. I think as we get more testing online, especially in the U.S., we're going to start understanding a lot better what exactly the nature of that situation and that dynamic actually is. But certainly it's been reassuring and positive to see that kids have been less susceptible to serious illness. But that still should give us pause because, as we know from a lot of other illnesses and infections, children can be the main spreaders of those illnesses in a community.
Caitlin, very briefly, are you, from your reporting, hearing a lot of parents just voluntarily keeping their children home?
I have not heard that yet. And the closures that we have seen have been pretty isolated. A handful of schools in Washington and Oregon and some private schools in California and also some in New York. So we really haven't seen a lot of that yet, but it's still early, so we don't really know.
Thank you very much. Caitlin Belsha is a national education reporter for Chalkbeat, and Ranu Dhillon is a physician and faculty member in global health equity at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And we're keeping our focus on how the coronavirus is affecting schools. Tell us how school closures are affecting you and your community by calling us at 1-877-8-MYTAKE.
Llámanos al 877-869-8253. Y muchas gracias.
Going to the DMV can be a nightmare, and if you've gone lately, you may have noticed longer lines than usual. That's because people around the country are rushing to get their Real ID card before the October 1st deadline. Now, have you heard of the Real ID before? If not, don't worry, you're not alone. Only one-third of people living in the USA actually have one of these little plastic cards.
This is a federally approved identification card that you would pick up from your state DMV. So it would be either a driver's license or a state ID card, but it meets a minimum security standard that's set by the federal government.
That's Stephanie Beasley. She's a transportation security reporter for Politico. Stephanie says, to get one of these new IDs, you're going to have to present a whole lot of documentation.
So you would need to bring proof of your U.S. citizenship or residency. You would need to bring proof of your address, your state address, and also proof of your Social Security number.
If you don't have those documents, you will not be able to get a Real ID card. Here in the U.S., you will also no longer be able to fly domestically or enter federal buildings without a real ID or other form of federally compliant identification, like a U.S. passport, after that deadline. It's going to complicate life for a lot of you. But Stephanie says the new cards are meant to make us all safer.
This is something that they basically enacted following September 11th because some of the hijackers had, you know, state ID cards, but they, of course, they were not U.S. citizens. So this is an extra security precaution to make sure that people aren't entering these buildings who shouldn't be there and people aren't flying if they should not be allowed to fly in the U.S.
So Congress passed this Real ID Act back in 2005, and it's now been 15 years later. Why is it taking so long to implement this?
Well, I think part of the difficulty was this is what you would call an unfunded mandate. So there wasn't any money attached to this. And it's requiring states to change their processes because not all of them were collecting the type of documents that are required. That means they might have to pour resources into new software that they're going to use. Maybe they have to, you know, hire more staff. So I think it's taken a long time for states to get on board with this. And also for them to kind of work with the Department of Homeland Security to make sure that everyone has a clear understanding of what documents are going to be required. For example, you know, I live in Maryland, and last summer they actually discovered that Maryland wasn't collecting all the correct documents. And so they actually had to recall or basically tell people, you need to come back to the DMV and show us these documents. Otherwise, we're going to have to take your ID card back.
There are a lot of folks in this country, and I know quite a few of them, who actually don't have these documents. And if you don't have federal identification, like a passport or a permanent resident card, what do you do?
Basically, you're not going to be able to get one of these real IDs, and it is going to make it more difficult for you. Say if you worked at a federal facility, maybe you were a janitor or someone else working in there, and now you don't have the real ID needed to get into the building. Or if you're trying to fly because, you know, some of the alternatives you could use would be like a passport or a military ID if you don't have your real ID. But if you don't have any of these documents, then basically TSA is not going to allow you on that flight.
Who is responsible for getting the word out about this? Who's in charge of the communication effort?
So I think the responsibility really falls to Homeland Security. And, you know, over the past year, they've had some kind of awareness campaign. So I don't know if you've flown recently, like TSA will have signs up at the checkpoint saying, you know, do you have your real ID?
You have to supply so much documentation. You got to walk into the DMV. Are there concerns about people's privacy?
That's definitely a big concern, particularly, I think, if you talk about the possibility of them maybe trying to move some elements of this to electronic submission, because then, of course, you have it in a database or you're sending it through the computer, and then there's a possibility of hacking, of course, with anything you're submitting online. So I think privacy concerns have definitely come up as part of these sort of ongoing discussions over the past 14, 15 years. The amount of information that you basically have to take with you.
Thank you so much. Stephanie Beasley covers transportation security for Politico. Stephanie, have a wonderful day.
Thanks, you too.
Let's head over to Alaska, where it's been challenging for some people to get their hands on the new form of ID.
My name is Tess Williams. I'm a reporter at the Anchorage Daily News.
Tess is closely following this story. I asked her, how many Alaskans actually have a real ID?
So 115,000 Alaskans have the Real ID so far. There's about 30 other forms of acceptable federally compliant IDs. And our DMV is estimating that almost half of our Alaskans have another form of ID.
So you say in addition to the Real ID, there's also 30 other forms of ID that you could use?
Yeah, there's about 30 forms. The biggest ones are like passports, military ID, veterans IDs, and tribal IDs.
Alaska seems synonymous with beautiful landscapes of mountains, greenery, snow, oceans, glaciers, and a lot of rural communities. In the middle of all that natural beauty, where is the DMV?
There are quite a few DMV locations. It is harder, though, in the rural communities because there are not DMVs in every rural community. And the biggest challenge in Alaska is that a lot of our communities are off the road system, so they're not connected by roadways. So to get from one community to the other, you sometimes have to fly.
So what does that mean for people who want to get one of these IDs? Are they actually booking a flight to get to the DMV?
that's something I think our state is still trying to figure out, and we've kind of been evolving plans for that. And so it started kind of with our DMV had this game plan that they announced in December, where they asked for donations actually to bring employees out to rural communities. We have a mobile machine that's able to make these real IDs or issue them. However, it's kind of hit some roadblocks. We have some budget issues here in Alaska right now. And so far, our DMV has done one visit to one community. Our DMV has kind of said that there seems to be a lot of people who do have tribal IDs, and is also leaning towards maybe that is the best like way to go for a lot of these rural communities also, just because the real ID requires like so much documentation to get one, which is kind of another barrier for getting one in a lot of places too.
So in light of all this difficulty trying to get workers to these isolated communities, is the state, did I understand you correctly, actually pushing for the use of tribal IDs or alternative forms of ID?
They've said that there doesn't seem to be as much of a need for real ID as they had initially thought. The push right away was that everyone needs a real ID. If you don't comply, you don't fly was kind of the slogan that I think TSA put out initially, and that Alaska had really touted back in December as a big thing. And then I think they have realized just how many barriers there are.
If the deadline comes and not enough people have actually gotten a real ID, what are some of the consequences that you foresee based on your reporting?
I think some things that lawmakers have been really concerned about, and some tribal leaders and people have testified during hearings have been very concerned about. I think the biggest one is like medical access. In a lot of these cases, you have to fly to go see a doctor if you live in a rural community. Sometimes if there's like a medical flight, a medevac flight, a patient is taken via like Life Flight helicopter into a bigger hospital like Anchorage or even Seattle. In that case, you would be able to get there if you didn't have a real ID. But then how do you get home afterward? You would need like real ID or federally compliant ID to get back home on a commercial flight.
It seems like Alaska is really pushing back on the federal government. Is there any indication that the U.S. government might give Alaska a little bit of leeway?
At this point, it does not seem like there would be another extension. I know Alaska's had several extensions, and when Real ID passed, there was a lot of contention at our state, and it was kind of met with bipartisan opposition just because Alaskans didn't view it as necessary and saw it kind of as like an overarching federal mandate and worried that it might be expensive at the state level to enforce.
Tess Williams is a reporter at the Anchorage Daily News. Tess, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And you can find information about real IDs at dhs.gov/real-id.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
Sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
When you think about space, do you fantasize about heading to the moon or Mars? The irony is, technology developed for space programs has a lot of everyday applications right here on Earth.
If you brush your teeth every morning like the dentist tells you to, when you squeeze that toothpaste out of that tube comes from space, and that's actually from the Apollo program.
Laura Winter is editor-at-large for AlJazeera.com, where she covers the global space race. Space programs and the technology that comes from them are not limited to wealthy countries like the United States. If you look at Africa, countries across the continent are increasingly looking to the stars.
Most recently, Ethiopia launched a satellite into space last December, but there have been several others, including Kenya, Egypt, Morocco, Nigeria, South Africa.
Yinka Adegoke is Africa editor for Quartz.
They've all launched their own programs or in partnership, a scientific, technological partnership with countries like China and Eastern European countries to expand their space policy. The African Union also has introduced an African space policy. So, you know, there's a lot going on there.
Yinka and Laura joined me this week to talk about why more and more developing countries are investing in space, even as they face earthly problems, and how space programs might provide new solutions. I asked Yinka, which developing nations around the world are making the biggest investments in satellites and space technology?
Well, the obvious one is China. And the way they tend to do this is, obviously, they have the technology, the launch platforms, the rockets, obviously. But what they tend to do is go to these countries and literally sell the idea of launching satellites, mostly satellites, because they're incredibly important for countries that are trying to develop. And they work hand in hand with them. Some efforts are fairly small, like the Ethiopia one I mentioned was, you know, it was a satellite that was just about, you know, the satellite itself was less than 50 pounds and costs less than $10 million in partnership with China. And China actually covered about, I think, about $8 million of that $10 million to sort of bigger projects like there was a $550 million project with Nigeria to launch two satellites into space either this year or next year. But the idea is that they partner with these countries because they do need them for their development.
One of the points you mentioned that's incredibly intriguing right now, given the politics of the world, is that China is going to some of these developing countries and saying, hey, let's partner on space programs or development. And it begs the question, is this an African program or is this a proxy Chinese program?
That's a fantastic question. I mean, it's like many things in the China-Africa relationship. The way China sees Africa or African countries is they see many of these countries as, hey, you're just like we were 30, 40 years ago. And all we're trying to do here is partner with you to help you develop where we've developed. And hey, well, you know, obviously there are advantages to us as well. This is why they talk a lot about the win-win relationship. And this is in all fields, not just in space. But it's never quite that simple as most things in the world. The Chinese tend to have an approach, which means they get into partnerships where they don't. It doesn't matter what the government is doing to its citizens, or there are no questions, the normal sorts of questions that I guess countries like the United States have asked African governments in the past. And, you know, that can get problematic. And in the case of space, there are questions as to whether some of these satellites would be used to spy on opposition candidates or leaders. And
so are you saying that there are concerns that space exploration could be used as instruments or vehicles of political manipulation on Earth within developing countries?
There are serious questions about this. And this applies to most things. This is not just about space. Let's be super clear about this. It's really about the African countries and the nature of the governments. If the particular governments, and this is not all by any stretch of the imagination, but there are a few governments that have had issues with, you know, playing fair when it comes to democracy and politics in their countries. And there are always concerns that some of these tools will be misused. And this applies to space, artificial intelligence, data collection. You know, so it's not really a space problem or a satellite problem, but more nature of the government.
Laura, you heard Yinka mentioning some of these concerns, but in terms of the positive side, what kind of technology is being used by developing nations that's being developed in space, and what are the benefits? How is it changing life here on Earth?
Well, there are a lot of benefits to Earth-observing satellites. And it's not really, you know, to shape the conversation correctly, the problem isn't so much space exploration. Exploration means going to the moon and digging in the regolith or going to Mars. The thing that Yink is really talking about here are the Earth-observing satellites. And in the Earth-observing satellites, the uses are land management, observing water management. You can even tell what kind of minerals are actually in the soil.
Minerals? You can tell that?
You can. It depends upon the technology that's on the satellite, but you can tell what sort of minerals are in the soil, and you can tell farmers when to rotate their crops. You can track mining. You can find illegal mining. You can actually see large masses of people moving. So you can find them. I mean, that's another problem. And when you're talking about great spaces of land, you know, just square miles, square kilometers that are difficult to discern and difficult to find people, Earth-observing satellites can really help in that.
One final question for the both of you. In terms of criticism, there are a lot of folks who will say these developing countries should be spending money on other things and not space. If you could briefly give me your view on that.
I understand the argument. And this has been a hot topic in India. This has been a hot topic in South Africa. This has been a hot topic even here in the United States. Why are we spending money on space? The point is there is that when you go to space, the investment you make and your return on that investment pays off a hundredfold. And each part of that technology, it's training, it's getting a better education, getting further along in engineering. You can take those engineering skills and put it into other areas. It doesn't just have to stay in space. It can go into avionics. So when you invest into space, you get a lot back in terms of your skills. You get a lot back in terms of your economy. And then you also have another vertical in your economy. For instance, again, I go back to South Africa because they're really working hard at this. But they're trying to enlarge what they do and provide space services to other African nations. And at the moment, they provide space services on solar weather for the whole Africa region, which they give to other nations, to their aviation industry. Because when you take off in a plane now, you have to file, the pilot has to file along with its report, a space weather report, and whether solar winds that are coming from the sun could possibly adversely affect the airplane. And South Africa provides that data.
Fascinating.
So there's so many different parts to space and so many different ways that different nations can participate in it and also make money from it and expand, you know, their own horizons, that it's really worth every penny, cent, dollar, dime, nickel that they put into it.
Laura Winter is editor-at-large for AlJazeera.com, and Yinka Adegoke is Africa editor for Quartz. Yinka, Laura, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for us today, except for one quick shout-out to the team that works so very hard to put this show together each and every week. Ethan Oberman, Jackie Martin, Jose Olivares, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Alexandra Boche is our senior producer. Vince Fairchild and Claire McKean are our board ops. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Our digital editor is Polly Arungu. Katarina Barton is our intern. David Gable is our executive assistant. And Lee Hill is our executive producer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and this is The Takeaway.